Labor Committee in Medford, Oregon. And it's 1:45.
That's not a bad direction.
Fine. The meeting will come to order, and first I'd like to thank the people of Medford, the Chamber of Commerce, and those that arranged this meeting to talk about a subject that is close to all of us and one that we're trying to solve, and namely that is workman's compensation, the high cost of workman's compensation here in the state of Oregon. There have been over 80 workman's compensation bills that are introduced in the 59th Legislative Assembly. The basic legislation in workman's compensation has been in effect since 1965. In Oregon, there are a number of problems in our present system, as indicated by the large quantity of bills dealing with workman's compensation. They are really the basic issues are the rising costs and the level of benefits. Before we go into this and before we hear testimony, I'd like to introduce members of my committee here. To my immediate right here is Senator Len Hannon, your own Senator Len Hannon, and Senator Jan Wires from Multnomah County, and Senator Cliff Trow from Benton County. Also, we have our legislative administrative assistant, Rich Wyman, and my legislative administrative assistant, Alma Trask, and we have our student intern, very valuable young man, is Luther Clevenger. So with this, I would also like to say that I'm real pleased to see an old friend of mine, and we've served in the legislature for many years together, Lynn Newberry. I would like to say this, that Lynn and I have had philosophical differences, but one of the most decent persons I've ever served with, and a man that I've always had a great deal of respect for. He fought on the issues, and that is an important thing, whether you're Republican or Democrat, is to discuss issues. And I can tell you this, that he was a difficult foe, but always stuck to the issues and never engaged in personalities, and I appreciate that in any person. So with that, we will begin with our witnesses, and I think, Lynn, would you like to lead off? Lynn Newberry.
Chairman, members of the committee, after that opening, I don't know whether I should have even appeared or not.
I'm sorry if I embarrassed you, Lynn.
But to put everybody's mind at ease, those are kind words, Dick, sincerely, and so that everybody else will be relieved. Notwithstanding those kind words, I don't intend to run for public office. For the record, my name is Lynn Newberry. I'm chairman of the Greater Medford Chamber Task Force on Workmen's Compensation and an employee of the Medford Corporation. On behalf of the Greater Medford Chamber, I want to thank you and to express our sincere appreciation for your bringing your committee to Medford to hold this hearing. And for those who may not know, the committee came in a helicopter and the weather was not the best, and they had to kind of find their way through the mountains into our valley, and so we deeply appreciate your risking life and limb for this particular meeting. We know it's difficult to arrange these meetings away from the Capitol, and it's an imposition upon your time, but we hope that our contribution to your deliberations on workman's compensation will make this trip an inconvenience worthwhile. In approaching the problems of workman's comp, this task force decided not to reinvent the wheel and duplicate the efforts of others. Our approach was to review the recommendation of the governor, the study done by Associated General Contractors, the recommendations of Associated Oregon Industries, and the Portland Chamber. We found that most of these recommendations identified the areas that were of greatest concern to us. And in general, we support the recommended changes proposed by the Associated Oregon Industries and Associated General Contractors. It was the feeling of our task force that the greatest contribution we could make would be to bring to the attention of your committee the problems with the present compensation system being experienced by the employers in our area. The testimony of the task force is not directed at any specific piece of legislation. For the most part, it will be confined to experiences selected to provide the committee with examples of the abuses of the present system, which we believe have made Oregon's workman compensation system one of the most expensive in the nation. The presentations made by the individual members of the Chamber Task Force represent the position and concerns of the Greater Medford Chamber. We have divided the subject matter only to eliminate redundancy insofar as possible. Members of our task force are identified on your witness list. And again, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we want to express our deep appreciation to you for coming to Medford. We hope that the insight we may provide may be valuable to you in considering revisions to Oregon law.
Thank you, Senator Newberry. I would like to say this, that to start the meeting off, that this committee will do something. After the last session of the Oregon legislature, I told the then labor leaders, and also had made this same speech at the labor convention, building trades convention, and various other labor conventions, that this session should be the millennium as far as labor and management are concerned. Told them that they had made great gains in the legislature, that they've had the workman's comp, unemployment comp tied to the cost of living, and bills that they've been trying to get through for 20 years were passed during the 73 and 75 session. What we should start talking about and what we should concern ourselves about as far as labor and management, both are concerned with jobs. Excuse me. Do we have any water here? So with this, I would like to say that we've had a great deal of cooperation between labor and management on workman's comp, as well as the environmental issue, which is a great concern, I know, to many of those that are in have to do with management as well as labor, because this is costing us, I'm sure, both are costing us jobs here in Oregon. And with this, we pledge that we will, to you, Senator Newberry, that we will and are working at it, and we will accomplish something this session as far as the high cost of workman's comp is concerned here in the state of Oregon. I hope also, as far as the environmental issue, and I'm not saying the true environmentalist, but I think in certain instances they've gone too far, and it has cost us jobs and has cost the employer untold millions of dollars here in the state of Oregon. So with this, we want to thank you for your testimony. If there's any questions, Senator Newberry, by any member of the committee,
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, we appreciate your coming. And insofar as getting something done, we're convinced down here that the approach you're taking will be fruitful. And we deeply appreciate that, too.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Trow.
Mr. Newberry, about the task force. How long have you been meeting, and how many members do you have, and so forth?
We've had, it's been a kind of an open task force, so that any member of the chamber or any member of the community could participate. And I expect that probably there were 12 to 14 employers involved at various times during our activities. Mostly it was a matter of homework, Senator, where we studied things at home and discussed them at a meeting. So there weren't a great deal of meetings, but rather just doing a lot of homework and discussing the issues at our meeting.
Do you know if other chambers of commerce over the state have been doing the same things?
I'm sorry, sir, I didn't.
Do you know if other chambers over the state have been doing the same thing, had groups studying the issue?
No, sir, I don't. The president of our chamber was concerned about the matter. He appointed me as chairman and asked us to do what we could to lend our support to some changes in the law.
Certainly is an important issue, and we commend you for doing it.
Senator Trow, the only other chamber I know of is a Portland chamber, has also made a study of workman's comp.
That's true.
There are no further questions. Thank you.
Mr.
Did you have a question?
Just
Senator
a comment. Senator Newberry, I'd like to thank you and the members of the executive board of the chamber for making these arrangements for us. And being gracious enough to meet us at the airport and pick us up. So,
otherwise, we'd have to walk here in the rain.
That's right. On behalf of the committee, we want to thank you for that.
Next witness is Joe Smith, is a member of the Chamber Task Force and also with the Medford Corporation.
Yes, Senator Groner, committee members, I'm Joe Smith, the Safety Director and Personnel Director for Medford Corporation and a member of the Medford Chamber of Commerce. Medford Corporation employs approximately 1,500 persons in various locations throughout the state of Oregon, primarily in the wood products area with some of the highest workman comp rates in the United States. We do care for our employees. We proudly provide full medical coverage for each of these employees and their families at no cost to the employee. This coverage cost us approximately $100,000 a month. This is medical coverage. We also care for our injured employees, and I'd like to repeat, our injured employees. Sometimes something is wrong with the workman's compensation law that permits abuses of the delivery system. The case I have covers some of these abuses by the claimants, the doctors, and the attorneys. I will respond to questions from the committee members if you have the time available after completion of testimony. I also have provided you a copy of my presentation and documentation on the case. The case is titled Doctor Shopping Under the Present Workman Compensation Law. The title is Willie. The individual was hired as labor in a sawmill in 3 January 1968. Quit in 13 September 1968, rehired 29 January 1969 as labor. On the 4th of October 73, he was hit by cant or a slab of lumber that came off of a roll case and grazed his left hip area. Examination and x-rays indicated no broken bones or damage other than a bruise on the left hip. The case started out as a medical-only claim with a minimum of lost time. Starting in November of 73, approximately a month later, the claimant has had medical services from the following medical professionals and up to this date. 14 doctors, 5 of them are neurosurgeons, 6 of them are orthopedists, 3 general practitioners, 2 psychiatrists, and a chiropractor. In addition to Providence Hospital, and a variety of physical therapy specialists. He has been x-rayed, provided orthopedic appliances, and most recently received an additional psychiatric exam by another psychiatrist. In April of 74, he was sent to Portland for evaluation by the Disability Prevention Division Workman Compensation Board. Cost to Medford Corporation, $919, negative findings. In June of 1974, he was released for work with the doctor in charge of his case. On June the 74, he was terminated from Medford Corporation because he failed to report for work after release with the doctor. On the 3rd of July, the Workman Comp Board entered a determination order, 32 degrees or 10% unscheduled disability, $2,200 paid by Medford Corporation. On the 9th of July, 6 days later, he retained an attorney. Request for hearing and greater medical award and continued medical services. On the 24th of August, the first call we had after that, after he was released, was from a chiropractor who was not in charge of his case. He is now the claimant's treating physician and the patient is not released for work. On 11 September of 74, the claimant applied for unemployment. The company contested the unemployment claim. We were overruled at the hearing. And he drew unemployment from 9/11/74 through 1/29/75. He terminated his unemployment benefits. He went into the hospital for another examination by a neurosurgeon, cost $1,100. 19th of March 1975, the hearing was canceled at the request of the claimant's attorney. On the 13th of August of 75, at the hearing, the claimant had 2 attorneys present and a psychiatrist at the hearing, said this individual has a third grade education. He's lost his will to work. Well, a lot of us have, I guess. His wife testified he had also lost his desire for sex. The only thing that I could say at that time, we contended that the claimant had refused to return to work after he'd been released by his doctor. We had sat on the sidelines and watched all this going on, and we still had a job for the individual. So the determination order by the hearings officer said to reopen the claim from time loss all the way back to 1974, 34 weeks of back payments. This also covered the period the claimant had drawn unemployment, $869, which is non-recoverable by the employer. We were also told to pay the outstanding medical bills. We paid that chiropractor that got him back into the stream $555. That's a lot of manipulation. And we paid also $1,800 for the attorney. We also covered his treatment from September 1975 through May of 1976 for psychiatric consultation, $1,010. They had a hearing called for 7 December 1976. The hearing was canceled at the request of the claimant's attorney for additional psychiatric evaluation by another psychiatrist. The two psychiatrists can't get together. They don't know the guy. He's just lazy. Present status. He is drawing Social Security disability. He is engaged in the junk car business and has continued this through all of his supposed disability since October of 1973. He's drawing welfare and food stamps. His wife's working. And now the claimant's attorney would like to settle without a hearing. The claim cost to date, $21,218. We think we can buy the attorney off for $2,200.
Thank you.
Yes.
Are there any questions that the committee would care to ask? I might say that one of the problems we have in the high cost of workman's comp is a problem, is the doctors. And I have written every doctor, every medical association in the state of Oregon the following letter. If you'll bear with me, it is short, and I'll read it to you. We, dear doctor, we in the legislature are struggling with the high cost of workman's compensation in Oregon and are examining methods in which these costs may be reduced. One of the major costs are in medical services, which are estimated to be $46 million annually. Some individuals have suggested that the establishment of fee schedules and the limiting of choice by the worker as to his physician is one direction which we should employ. This may be a viable solution. The area of temporary total disability payments is estimated to cost industry in excess of $160,000 daily. One method that we can use to reduce these costs is the early identification of those workers who can benefit from vocational assistance, such as occupational assistance for those occupationally handicapped or vocational training for those vocationally handicapped. Experts in the fields of rehabilitation for the injured worker state that the success of rehabilitation is dependent to a large degree on early recognition of those workers needing help. The Workmen's Compensation Board has established rules relative to the reporting of injured workers in a timely and expeditious manner. It is imperative that these rules be strictly adhered to if we are to enjoy any excess in the rehabilitation of the injured worker. And I might say this is one of the problems where the doctors are not reporting. We have the service coordinators that stop calling the doctors. They may spend a half a day trying to see the doctor. So we're trying to, there's been an extreme lack of cooperation, and we have doctors even in the Medford community, it's been alerted to me by the Workmen's Compensation Board that where there is a problem that exists here among certain doctors. Expert in the field of rehabilitation of injured workers all place early identification of the worker for rehabilitation to be primary in the success of the program. I have the feeling that the attention given to early identification of the worker who needs both vocational assistance is cursory at its best. I can't understand this when it is estimated that for every dollar spent on rehabilitation, $35 is returned to the community for the worker who is rehabilitated. The current statistics on the identification of the injured worker is running approximately 8 months after the date of injury. For referral to the service coordinator as long as 19 months before he gets into a vocational training program. The Workmen's Compensation Board has established rules relative to the reporting of injured workers in a timely and expeditious manner. It is imperative that these rules be strictly adhered to if we are to enjoy any success in the rehabilitation of the injured worker. And this is one of the problems that we are having with the doctors, and I hope that we do have cooperation, and probably we may possibility that this committee, we're certainly going to consider it, that we recommend that the workman's compensation go back to the fixed fee schedule for this reason. If they have a fixed fee for a broken arm or whatever injury that may occur, they're going to get so much money out of it, perhaps they'd speed up the process instead of holding on to this injured workman forever. If they knew they were only going to get so many dollars for whatever the injury may be.
If I might comment, they'd probably end up under your system referring him to another doctor and starting him all over again. The best vocational rehabilitation that I'm aware of is good, honest work. The employer does not have anything to do in the program, and he's footing all the bills. If they would get him back to the place of business where the honest work is, we think that is some of the best rehabilitation that's available.
We have to speed up the system. As far as the doctors are concerned, if they get him back and recommend that he's through and get the word to the Workman's Compensation Board or to the carrier that he is available for work, but this they're not doing. And I'm not stereotyping all the doctors, but there are a number of doctors that fail to do this.
I know that.
And it's the job of the service coordinator to contact the employer and find out if a job is available. And this is one of the reasons, I don't know if the Medford Corporation is self-insured or not.
We're on a cash flow with SAFE.
Well, the self-insured are doing a much better job than those that are insured with the insurance company.
We're trying to do better.
Okay. Are there any further questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Trow.
Just a couple. How unique is the case you've given us? Do you have lots of other cases like this?
Yes. This was sort of an outstanding example when you take that number of doctors for an individual where they've never found anything with myelograms, hospitalization, and so forth. And no, it's not just one peculiar case. There are quite a few of them, and sometimes it can become quite exasperating trying to run a place of business with quite a few of your workforce off, just doctor shopping and bouncing from one to the other. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Groner.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Lyle Villor, also with the Chamber Task Force, and he's with Collins and Villor Attorneys.
Chairman, members of the committee, I am an attorney. After Mr. Smith's presentation, I don't know whether I should testify.
Not one of your clients, was he?
Yeah. No, Mr. Smith has been my client. I primarily represent employers and private insurance carriers and self-insureds in the practice of workman's compensation, which takes a great deal of my practice. And I have been asked to speak here on the appeal process, which I know is of great concern to many of us as attorneys, and I hope many of you in the legislature. I would like to start my presentation briefly by tracing a case which is somewhat similar, frankly, to Mr. Smith's case, involving a lady who worked at State and Canning Company up in the Valley, and I happen to represent the private insurance carrier for State and Canning Company. She had placed her hands in alternating and hot and cold water, and as a result, she sustained some type of a burn injury to the hand where she alleged that she had some neurological deficits in the hand. This primarily was concerned with the right hand, but after 18 months of treatment with about 12 different doctors, she commenced having symptoms in the left hand. And she then alleged, even though her original 801, the report of occupational injury or disease, was limited to the right hand, commenced making noises about wanting compensation for the left hand, which was after closure by a determination order when this was first discovered. The private insurance carrier denied benefits for the left hand and proceeded to hearing on two questions. One, the extent of disability to the right hand and whether or not the continued complaints in the left hand were the result of an occupational injury or disease. We went to hearing. We prevailed on both issues, limiting her disability. In the course of investigation, we determined that she was utilizing her hands quite freely, and we had an investigator take movie film of her from the road outside of her house where she was using her hands to hang curtains and do various things. Of course, I believe that investigation is the best way, at least from the attorney's standpoint, to defeat these situations that go on and on. However, her attorney was not satisfied with that, and we went on to the Workman's Compensation Board, who affirmed the hearing's referee. We went on to the Circuit Court in Linn County, who affirmed the Workman's Compensation Board, and we finally wound up in the Court of Appeals. I have brought my file with me to show you what about a 4 or 5 inch file consists of on one of these appeals, and then I have brought with me the decision of the Court of Appeals, which consists of a cover page, and the entire opinion is contained in about 25 or 30 lines, where they finish up by saying, suffice it to say that she is fortunate to have received any award for permanent disability. We find no substantial evidence supporting her contention as to her left hand. We never could settle this case with the claimant's attorney, and of course he felt that he might find a sympathetic ear at some level of the appeals process, the multiple level of the appeals process, at the board, with the circuit judge in their county, or at the Court of Appeals. Fortunately, for my client, he did not. But I think this is an example of the waste and cost and expense in the system of having multiple levels of de novo appeals. I added up the costs of this appeal when we incorporated our investigation, the attorney fees, and the claims handling. I put in some approximate amounts, but the total cost of handling this case came to around $4,000 to $4,500. For the employer. Had this woman received a permanent disability of 50% to her left hand, I believe the figure would have only been around $5,300. And so, but we had no choice but to resist at each stage because we couldn't give this woman a sufficient money. I cannot blame her attorney in this situation for pressing this because the woman herself was aware of the appeals process and being able to go through these multiple levels of appeals. And of course, if her attorney had not appealed at her request, he would have been guilty of legal malpractice and could have been sued himself. Because in many instances, the claimants in these types of cases are very knowledgeable about the system. And I think in any plant, such as even the Medford Corporation, the word gets around as to how to work at the system or how to continue and what the law is. We have a lot of so-called company lawyers in that situation. The State Bar in 1970, I believe the 1970 committee reports, which I'm sure you gentlemen are aware, recommended legislation at that time, which would have eliminated some of the multiple levels of appeal, which I think that legislation is some of the legislation which is before you. Basically, the State Bar Committee on Workmen's Compensation investigated by talking to other attorneys and by trying to put together a package, and this was a joint committee of claimants and defense attorneys, something which would have avoided this multiple level of appeals process, but unfortunately was not successful at that time. The committee report from the State Bar at that time suggested that after studying the system, and particularly studying the state of Oklahoma, where they have a workman's compensation appeals court, recommended that we do something similar in the state of Oregon. We did not feel that it should rise maybe to the level of a court such as was done in Oklahoma, but to eliminate all of the de novo process except one, which would be to a workman's compensation board. We felt that it was very important, and I still feel that it is very important, that we eliminate one of the levels of appeal prior to reaching the circuit, or prior to reaching to the Court of Appeals. I would recommend to you, as an attorney, that strong consideration be given to establishment of a Workman's Compensation Appeals Board, staffed by three people, to eliminate their administrative functions in running the Workman's Compensation Board and have the Compliance, Evaluation, Disability Prevention Divisions and the others run by an administrator, and let them handle the matter in a quasi-judicial fashion. And let the hearing's referee's decision be appealed only to the Workman's Compensation Appeals Board on a de novo status. I feel that it is extremely important to staff the Workman's Compensation Appeals Board with people who are knowledgeable in the field of workman's compensation, who do have some training in that issue, and who are knowledgeable in the legalities of workman's compensation, because a certain large percentage of their appeals will not be just an evaluation of disability, but they will certainly have to handle certain legal questions which are handled properly and proper decisions written would avoid appeals then to the Court of Appeals. I would further recommend that then the appeal to the Court of Appeals not be on a de novo basis, but be on the basis of as in any other case where errors of law can be corrected at the appeals court level, but that the entire case can't be re-examined for an evaluation of disability or an evaluation of compensability. In this recommendation, I'm leaving out the circuit courts of the state of Oregon, and I know there's quite a bit of controversy in whether or not the circuit courts should play a part in this appeals process. And the controversy in 1970, which I think is continuing amongst the lawyers, is whether we should have the board or the circuit courts. I feel that the circuit court level at this time leads to a drastic problem in the uniformity of decisions and workman's compensation. I have practiced in 14 or 15 of the counties in the state of Oregon for various employers appearing before various judges, and I can certainly say that I can get a far different decision in one county before a certain judge than I can get in another county. And if we have something come before one board who are going to make the decisions as to the extent of disability, it will lead to uniformity, it will lead to guidance to the hearings referees, and I think it will give more uniformity to their decisions, for they will know then what the board will do. I think right now the board is an ignored portion of the appeals process, because any claimant's attorney knows that he is just going through the steps at the board level and that he can go to his circuit court, and that's the decision that will change anything as far as the hearings division is concerned. And so for the expense, the two criterion of the expense involved in the system because of the multiple levels of appeals, and to hopefully put some uniformity into this decision, into this field, so that we as attorneys and employers know and can evaluate the cost of claims before those claims get into the hearings process. I feel that this is the best step to take with a strengthened board of trained people in this area. If there's any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer.
Thank you very much for those remarks, and we appreciate it from your experience. It has been very helpful to the committee. Do you have any questions, any member of the committee?
I just wondered if you made some sort of a fiscal impact to determine if we did streamline the appeals procedure the way you've suggested, how much money that would save the employers. Would that be a substantial saving?
I think that in talking, I do not have any figures concrete down, but in talking to some of the people, particularly I think John Baker at the hearings division, who's done quite a bit of studying in this, that the hearings and appeals process as far as actual costs of attorneys is still a small percentage of the total process. I think that Senator Groner hit the nail on the head when our medical costs are our large percentage. But I think that any saving, and of course I think that in the amount of money that's being spent in workman's compensation, it would be a significant saving. And I don't remember the total number of appeals that went through the Court of Appeals level, but certainly there were a substantial amount, and it would be a savings not only to the workman's compensation system and to the employers, but I think it would be a savings to the state itself, because it certainly is costly to take cases before the Court of Appeals and to the circuit courts, and just saving of their time. And I know that there have been some suggestions that possibly the Court of Appeals should be expanded because of their workload. And if we had a strong board making these decisions, possibly that could be considered in relation to the other bills as far as expansion of the court system.
What would happen if the de novo appeal that an employee got at the board level, for whatever reason, was not a fair hearing? When, if ever, could could there be a chance for that employee to get a fair hearing if you denied any further de novo hearings?
Well, I think we can say the same thing now. What if at the Court of Appeals it isn't a fair hearing? And at some point we have to stop. We can't go on ad infinitum because it won't be fair. But I think that we have hearing referees in this state who are interested in doing a good job, and but they do lack uniformity in their decisions because they don't have it. And
let me ask this: isn't this true of any judge? I mean, you've been practicing law for.
Yes.
Where is there a judge that has uniformity in decisions?
Well, we hope that if judges make decisions, they get guidance from the higher court. And I'm saying that at this point, we aren't getting that guidance on a great number of cases because of the pyramid effect of going all the way up.
I might say that in regard to this, that we did that I appointed a ad hoc committee composed of trial attorneys, labor, management, and worked for since the beginning of the legislature on this, and we do have the three bills drafted. And I might just give you a glimpse, and this is the first time that anyone has known as far as their recommendations are concerned. And of course, this has to go before the full committee. They'd require that on appeal, the hearing division cannot consider evidence that has been that has not been considered by the evaluation division, and they at the same time allow the claimant or carrier to request and receive reconsidered by the evaluation division, providing there's that there's additional medical evidence or appeals time is extended for a period in time required for reconsideration, and claimant's notice of determination should be changed to indicate that the review may be requested without requiring a formal hearing. We'd also limit the function of the Workers' Compensation Board to review the appeals from the hearing division, to review erroneous or unwarranted acts or proceedings, or where judgment is miscarried or justice or will result in a substantial injury to legal right, eliminate the circuit court, and retain the Court of Appeals de novo.
I think review. That's a step in the right direction, Senator.
This is the recommendation, and I think we'd also retain the Supreme Court in the appellate procedure, yeah, in the present role.
I meant to say that I would suggest that retention of the Supreme Court on a petition for review,
right,
as it is now, yes. I didn't mean to let them up. Thank you very much.
Paul
Kinmon.
I'm sorry.
Paul Kinmon, Bear Creek Corporation. I'm very happy to see that we all agree that there changes are required or necessary in our workers' compensation laws, but I'm sure we won't all agree on what specifically these changes should be. I've been very reading the records of your committee and the things you've been talking about, the testimony you've been taking, and I notice there's a lot of emphasis placed on the two-way system versus the three-way system, or in the case of shortening the appeals procedures we just heard. Although these are very, very important questions, I'm here to say that we can live with those, no matter which way they go. But there is something that we cannot live with, and that is the drift of workman's compensation system towards a form of socialized medicine. Now, socialized isn't a good word for it because it's being paid for by the employer and not by the taxpayer. But that's the way we're heading. I would like to speak today for House Bill 2797, which redefines compensable injury for purposes of the workman's compensation law to include physical injury caused by violent and external means. My testimony is based on real-world experience as an employee relations manager for a local company whose workman's compensation premium totals $600,000 a year. So you can see we have a considerable stake financially in the deliberations of your committee. Although our premiums are reaching almost astronomical proportions, I can say categorically that we very rarely have an accident. That is an accident for which this law was written in the first place. The majority of our claims are in payment of aggravations of ailments. Some of them are congenital weaknesses that the people bring with them when they come to work for us. Some of them are just the body wearing out over years of working and playing. It should be remembered that the employee spends about three times as much time playing and doing other things as he does working. Things are happening to him during that time. And yet, when it comes to a workman's compensation claim, the referee seems to forget that. And that's what I want to talk about here today. I want to give you some examples. I have hundreds of them. You don't want to listen to them. I picked out three or four very short ones, which I think will point out the point I'm trying to make. At a recent hearing before a referee, we protested a alleged neck injury, which hadn't been reported. It wasn't witnessed. It came to our attention only about a week after it purportedly happened. In the testimony as to whether it was a work-related injury or not, the employee quoted his physician, who advised him with these words, "Wherever it started to hurt, that's where it happened." Our bill for this incident is already $4,200, with a sizable award pending because he said it started to hurt while I was standing here in front of my press. I'm sure you can recognize the implications of this kind of reasoning in administering the workman's compensation law. As I see it, this law is at present is to protect three kinds of employees: those who would under no circumstance take advantage of the law, and thank heavens they're the majority, they're the most of people. Secondly, are those employees who would use it to their own advantage. And third, are those employees who don't yet realize how generous the administrators of this law can be. Now, what I worry about is what's going to happen when they find out how generous the administrators of this law can be. Imagine, if you will, somebody starting to print posters that boldly say, "Wherever it started to hurt, that's where it happened." And you find these posted in every bar, in every den across the state. And these posters become as popular, "If it feels good, do it." Can you imagine what will happen? This affects the thinking of our people. Wherever it started to hurt, that's where it happened. Even worse, if somebody took those lyrics and put them to music, and then got somebody like Elton John to record it. Imagine what that would do. This will only lead for more and more people getting hurt, but waiting until they get to work before they say, "Ouch." Unless they change, similar to House Bill 2797 is written into law, employers will have no protection whatsoever from those persons who knowingly or unknowingly use the law to cover medical expenses for ailments other than occupational illness and injury. Let me give you a case in point, another one. An employee, 55 years of age, complained of back pains while lifting a tray weighing 5 to 6 pounds. Her doctor diagnosed her condition as osteoporosis. Now, I have to admit that my medical background is limited to ninth grade physiology. Never went beyond that. But even with that, I know that osteoporosis is a degenerative disease which accompanies getting old, growing old. Now, could you consider this to be an occupational injury? You bet it was, because this case has so far cost us $20,058. Second case, a 48-year-old woman employed by us less than 90 days complained of a sore arm while she was affixing small aluminum tags to rose bushes going by on an assembly line. She consulted a physician who performed surgery on her elbow. She didn't work for us after that. Almost a year later, she started complaining about back pains. She went to another doctor, and he performed a laminectomy on the small of her back. Here was an arm injury which supposedly had been corrected by surgery. All of a sudden, it shifted back to the small of her back. Now, in the testimony, no consideration was given to what has she been doing for the year since she had the elbow surgery. It has been ruled that the back injury is compensable, that is, happened as a result of the elbow injury. Third case. On a Sunday afternoon, one of our supervisors was called up by one of our employees who asked if, she said, "I've been injured. Could you come down and take me to emergency at Rogue Valley Hospital?" The supervisor responded to the call. When she got there, she found the employee obviously under the influence, or at least to her, under the influence of alcohol. That's why she couldn't drive to the hospital herself. She took her to the emergency room. The treating physician, in noting the condition of the patient on his report, said that the patient had extensive arm, chest, and back injuries, or bruises, rather. Arm, chest, and back bruises. The patient told the doctor that this was an occupational injury, that it happened when I fell against a file cabinet on the previous Friday. This was on Sunday. This claim was then processed as an industrial accident, and of course, SAFE paid the premium, or we paid the premium, really, the company, through SAFE. $102 was the cost for this emergency treatment. Now, obviously, we denied the claim when it came to our attention, because how could a person injure their chest, arms, and back very seriously falling against a file cabinet in a room which contained 50 other employees? Nobody saw it, nobody heard it, didn't even hear her say, ouch. We denied the claim, but there is no way for us to recover that $102 except through civil action. I know that there are some skeptics among you and among other legislators who say these things just don't happen, that these are just cases we draw on at random. That's not so, and I wanted to prove this to myself. Let me tell you what happened. On last April, I went to a doctor. I said the complaining about a pain in the arch of my left foot. He took x-rays. He found there were no broken bones. He said it's probably a muscle strain. It'll take a little while for it to go away. And he asked me how it happened. I said it happened when I was coming down a ladder on a dock, and I plunged 15 inches from the lower rung to the ground, and I injured my foot on the way down, or when I hit. He said, when did it happen? I said, last November. Now remember, this was in April. 5 months previous, I said it happened. He asked me why I hadn't come to him sooner. I said I thought it would go away. So he records it as an industrial injury. It was processed and, of course, claimed. The $65 charge for my treatment was paid by, again, the company through SAFE. Now, here was an accident which was unreported, unwitnessed, had occurred 5 months earlier. And yet, you see, I got it paid for through the company, because all I have to say is it happened at work, and nobody will question my word for that. Although my files bulge with other cases such as this, hopefully this will make my case for Hospital 2797. As time goes on, our list of compensable injuries and illnesses more clearly resemble a Army sick call than it does workman's compensation. We have such things as I turned my ankle while throwing a frisbee out in the parking lot. That actually happened the other day. That's a compensable injury. We pay for that. Things like that. I cannot believe that the legislators who originally drew up the workman's compensation law expected that the employer would be required to accept the financial burden of all the physical problems, congenital and otherwise, of each new employee who has lived, worked, and played for many, many years prior to their employment date. I don't say that their medical care shouldn't be available for these people. It should be. But that's a social problem, not one to be covered by the blanket of workman's compensation. I'll give you all a copy of my notes, and anybody have a question?
I'd like to say that we agree with you and recognize that there are this problem, but I think what you should also realize that it's not necessarily the legislature, the laws that the legislature passed, it's the determination of the court. For example, many people think the odd lot doctrine was something that was discovered by the legislature. It was not. It's a determination of the courts. And I think that you'll find that the courts have a more liberal interpretation of the law here in Oregon, and our laws may even be similar to other states, but their interpretation more liberal here in the state of Oregon than they are elsewhere. But we find that even the odd lot doctrine, the determination by the courts in other states, the odd lot, they're determining the same as making the same determination as we do here in Oregon. So it is spreading, and we are proposing legislation to to stop what what you've alluded here to today, and hopefully that we can accomplish this.
I would agree that the problem is not in the law. The problem is the administration of the law. That is why wording such as House Bill 2797 becomes necessary, because somehow you have to guide the thinking of the administrators through language.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Wires.
Well, you mentioned that you think that people should have medical care, but shouldn't be the response. That's a social problem. You also mentioned Elton John and in close proximity, if it feels good, do it. I think if it feels good, do it was made famous by a man named Ernest Hemingway, who is a man elder to you if he were still alive. So I feel some of this just sweeps on by me because this is my first session in the legislature, but I wonder if you have been a leader in providing medical care for everyone. As one who hasn't been able to afford it part of my adult life, I look at you quite a bit older than I am, and with most of the time that I've been alive, you've had a lot more power than I have, and I wonder what you've done in that area when we have so many people who can't afford decent medical care in this country today.
I would be very happy to answer that question, but I don't think it's germane to our discussions here today.
But it's germane if we're going to put people off of medical care through their employer, which I agree is not the idea of workman's compensation, but I would submit that the reason why many people have gone to that, and perhaps doctors have stretched the law and judges have stretched the law, has been out of a perhaps overly bleeding heart humanitarian attitude, but it is in the background of a lack of medical care for people. You brought it up. That's
okay,
why
let me answer your question this
it.
Way. We have a group medical plan for our employees. We have those same employees who are drawing workman's compensation, in many cases, could have drawn it through the medical program, group medical program. We have even had people who have filed a claim under our group medical program only to withdraw the claim later on, and in fact, have been paid off under the group plan, and say, no, I'd rather file this under workman's compensation because workman's compensation is far more generous.
This woman that had the arm that's turned into a phony back claim, and she was no longer working with you when she came up with the back claim, was she?
No.
Would your medical plan for your employees have covered that back claim?
It would have covered the arm claim originally, yes.
But would it have covered the back claim after she left your employ? It would have still covered her back?
Our group medical program in the hospital covers 90% of costs.
For how long after they're not working for you, though?
None after working for us.
So she couldn't have come back and
no.
convinced somebody it was a re-injury, she wouldn't have had medical care, would she?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hannon.
Paul, one of the things that you have sent to Representative Brad Morris and I for approximately the last 18 months, it's been a whole record of cases that you've verified. I would like to have you share one thing that I don't think you touched on that's important for this committee to realize. That is that anytime the injured workman goes to a doctor the first time, he has to go there under a requirement of law to define if it is indeed a compensable injury. And I think that's the reason that you're coming out with your support for House Bill 2797. And that's the one thing I wish you'd touch on just briefly is you mentioned one time in a letter that a person could go with a common cold, but they'd have to accept them the first time if there's a related injury associated with that and they're treated for everything.
The first time you go to the doctor, it has to be paid for within a specified time
right.
by SAFE. Many times, the first we hear of a person, an employee, visiting a doctor is when we get a letter from SAFE saying, why didn't you file an 801? We didn't even know it.
Right.
Because the person went on their own and said, I was injured at work. The doctor accepts that and files a claim. SAFE then gets a claim. They pay it. They have, in the case I mentioned of the woman who was with the bruises, in this particular case, they had to pay it so we could deny it. But we have no recourse.
That's right.
And of course, obviously, the woman didn't question the denial because her bills were paid. In the case of my foot injury, the smartest thing that SAFE could do was to pay the $65 because I could stretch this out into a permanent partial, very simply, with a good attorney.
Any further questions?
I just have one. Your testimony was really persuasive, I think, about the phony claims, and then you go on to say that House Bill 2797 would help in this situation. I wonder if it really would help. For instance, the woman who bangs herself off the file cabinet or alleged that, or your own phony claim where you make up the fact that you slipped off the ladder. It seems to me that redefining the compensable injury as a physical injury caused by violent or external means would pick up both those. What the real problem is the discretion of the hearing officers or the referee who are willing to take uncorroborated testimony at its face value. And boy, that's a hard thing to get at through legislation. But I think I disagree with you a little bit that 2797 is going to cure the problem. I think it might help in the case of truly degenerative conditions such as heart disease or cardiovascular disease.
Yeah, it would apply to
those two examples. Right. It would
apply to the conditions where if there is an external and violent injury caused by some external or violent means, normally that would be an observed accident or injury. Most of ours are not observed. They're not reported. We have a very careful reporting system for accidents. They are not reported.
We just have a system of referees who are taking uncorroborated testimony then.
That's right.
Further questions? If not, thank you, Mr. Keenan.
Thank you, Senator.
Jim Poole with Jim's Floor Coverings, and also a part of the Chamber Task Force.
My name is Jim Poole. I'm with a local retail firm here in town. Paul pretty well covered a lot of the things that I wanted to say today, but I have compiled here a case history. First, about a year ago, workman's compensation came to some of my friends and competitors in the area that I work in, and told them that people that we had considered subcontractors for some 20 years were going to have to pay workman's compensation payments, retroactive as far back as a year and a half. This was eventually dropped, and the fees and the charges and everything was pretty well forgotten about. One thing that came out during that period of time, one of the field representatives for SAFE told one of my friends or competitors that the primary reason for this at that time is because SAFE was low on funds. And I don't doubt it a bit. We recently had a lady that worked in a room 25 foot square with two other ladies. She's worked there for some years. She asked for a vacation, the second vacation in the same year, and we denied it. A couple of weeks later, the Sunday before the Monday she wanted the vacation to start, she turned up at Providence Hospital with a severe injury. She claimed that this accident had happened on Tuesday of the prior week. Yet Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, with the three ladies sewing and talking in this room, there was never any mention of an accident, never any mention of pain. 6 days later, she shows up at the emergency room in so much pain she can't stand one more moment. We denied this claim from the very beginning. We complained about it, but she was paid anyway. It was a small amount of money. I think it ended up to be $200, not counting the hospital. Myself my partner and my wife were very dedicated to our business. We work as many as 100 hours each week. I don't have the facilities. I don't want to police the Workmen's State Compensation Board. I don't want to tell them how to do their business. I don't want to have to go back and say, you're wrong, and I'm going to show you why. Whoever handled this at the time, I'm sure, was a competent person. But the lady got her week's vacation, only she turned it into two with pay. And it just seems to me that if I could dream up anything out of my mind to make this any more unrealistic, I couldn't think of anything to put to it. If you multiply this $200 and this injustice and this frustration times thousands throughout the state of Oregon, then you know how I feel and the other thousands that are like me. I have a very small business, me and my partner. We don't claim to furnish insurance to anyone, absolutely no one. We would like very much to make a dollar. We've got our neck out on the line, and we work very hard to do that. So if they need an insurance policy, there are literally hundreds of people on the city streets that can sell it to them. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Poole, and we appreciate your problem, and I think this committee is working toward that end and trying to solve this problem, and we're cognizant of this, and we've heard similar testimony.
I'm sure.
Elsewhere, they feel that, and in fact, labor itself is concerned. I'm talking about organized labor. They're willing, they want the person that's injured on the job to be compensated as they should be.
Absolutely.
But they don't favor this type of claims and are doing anything and cooperating with us, with this committee, in trying to solve that problem. They want, what they realize, that this fund, the insurance, the compensation, workman's compensation, is becoming so high and out of sight that it could affect their benefits in the future. And it's also affecting jobs because it's hampering expansion of industry here in the state of Oregon, among other things. So we appreciate your testimony.
It's not the $200 as much as it's the frustration and the helpless feeling that you have. There's no place to go for help. You're completely at the mercy of one individual and his fleeting thought at that moment. My partner recently broke a leg. He was off work for 2 months. His hospital bill was over $1,000. His leg's going to be 1 inch shorter than the other one. And yet, that was not ever turned into workman's compensation. So, it's not just, gentlemen, the way it is. It just simply isn't. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anna Tucker, West Main Rental, also with the Chamber Task Force.
Anna Tucker, West Main Rentals. I didn't bring any supportive evidence for a claim I had for an injury.
Would you pull the mic a little closer? We can.
I didn't bring any supportive evidence I have also for a claim injury because at the time, before the testimony started, I assumed it was too small, and it was basically a self-injury. We hired a young man who was a certified welder, and he was a very good welder. And about a week after we had hired him, we found that he couldn't read. So we decided that perhaps he would make a good employee if we could work around this problem. The day that the payroll checks would come out for that month, and he didn't take a draw either, though I think he was fairly needy, he put his hand in the belt ribbon engine and skinned one finger. Of course, he was off work for a month. And in between this time, we had intended on letting him go anyway because he went around telling all the other employees that he had a heart problem, that he had ulcers. So he really did not want to work. So after he received this skinned area on his finger, of course, he submitted a claim. They considered plastic surgery on his finger. He received a full month's benefits, which, like I said, I don't know what the figures are. But he really, and then after this, I went to see him because he had some items that belonged to our store. And he said, you can't let me go because of my injury. I can force you to put me back to work. And I told him, well, if that's what you feel should happen, I said, then we will put you back to work. But he did not want to come back to work. And then he proved to the state employment service that he indeed could read after he could not read while he was in our employ, and that he did not have a heart problem, and that he did not have ulcers. He just, in fact, wanted to go back on welfare, which he had been on previously, and also the state benefits. Another problem I'm having, which I wrote a letter about, is having to do with classifications with Northwest Rating Bureau. I'm with a private insurance carrier, and I originally thought that my problem was there, and I had been considering changing over to SAFE. For the past 2.5 years, I thought that the way I was classified was a little out of line. My classifications, at West Main Rental, we have some large equipment, and we were classified mainly with machinery dealers in OC. It's 8107. I felt that this did not fit all of the employees we had, and I kept checking with my insurance company. I had 4 different local agents that I talked to, and they said, well, there's nothing we can do about it. It has to go to the Northwest Rating Bureau. Finally, one of them agreed to, and he told me that the insurance company had to ask for an inspection. They finally did so. And about 4 months after they supposedly asked for the inspection, I called the Northwest Rating Bureau and asked them if indeed they were going to send somebody. A week later, the inspector did come out. Now, the reason that I went ahead and asked for this inspection was that I also belonged to a rental association, and I checked with some of the other stores. And out of the 6 stores that I did check with, 3 of them have a classification of 8010. It's called tool rental stores. 6 of them do. And 3 also use 8810, which is clerical, for some of their office help. Now, I am in the same business, I have the same equipment, and I get my classification is 8107. The difference in rate is approximately $5. My rate is $5 higher. And I could see no justification for my rate being any different than any store who has the same tools, basically, the same industry. When the inspector came, he asked me if this would cause litigation between myself, my insurance company, or SAFE. Well, I said, no, that was not the intention. Just basically that I wanted to be given the same consideration that the other stores who are in the same business be given to me. In other words, I have several employees, one of whom is an art student. He has no interest in diesel mechanics. He's got no interest in hydraulics, air, nothing. He's not interested in learning. Therefore, we don't put him around any of the heavy equipment that we do have. He basically works with small engines and the same items that all the other stores have. And that classification, which they call tool rental stores, when we finally got that particular classification, they call it hardware sales. But I can't put those same men that do the same job in that category. And at my store, 8010, which is hardware sales or tool rental stores, I can only put my counter girls who do nothing but lift a pencil and write up contracts. And my problem is that I don't feel that I was given the same consideration that the same type of businesses were. And after the inspection, it did not change whatsoever.
I might say that you should have probably taken this up with the insurance commissioner if you feel you are being discriminated. Perhaps you have.
Well, I was told by my insurance company, basically, that whatever the Northwest Rating Bureau said, that was as far as you could go. And I did write Gary Wilhelms, and he said the letter that he would get in touch with the insurance commissioner and give him a copy of the letter. But at the time, the inspection wasn't finalized. So now I will write him again and also get in touch with the insurance commissioner.
Thank you. Are there any questions? If not, thank you, Ms. Tucker. Dick Gordon with the Memorial Hospital, the Rogue Valley Memorial Hospital. That's right. I wondered what that RV stood for. I've received numerous letters from Dick Gordon. I don't mind him getting on my back, but I don't like those spurs.
Well, I readily admit there has been some during the past several sessions as my problems with workman's compensation continue to increase. For your information, Rogue Valley Memorial Hospital is a regional medical center. Points of 950 individuals. We service a region in Southern Oregon and Northern California. Our normal premium for workman's comp is about $225,000 a year in Oregon. If we were a hospital located in any of the six major industrial states in the country, averaging those premiums together, we would be paying approximately 50% less in workman's compensation insurance coverage. I believe previously, Senator Groner, I've sent you this information comparing other state hospital premiums compared to the Oregon rates. I also today want to really talk on aggravation, which several other people have mentioned. To me, aggravation takes several forms. First of all, it's the employee that we hire, and we hire that individual knowing that they have a physical or mental problem. The second aggravation is when the person has worked for us for some period of time and they develop a physical or mental problem that has nothing to do, with their work at the hospital. But at some point in time, under either of the aggravation cases, they eventually become workman's compensation and oftentimes covering these people for their disability for the rest of their life. The system really has become another social welfare program with employers paying the cost. Doctors tend to claim as much as possible under workman's compensation because they receive full payment for services rendered. 100% of their bill is paid. There's no hassle to their patient to try to obtain the balance of payment as they would under private insurance carriers or group insurance carriers or under simply no insurance at all where the person had to come up with the money. In other words, it's the it's easy way to get the payment paid in full. It's not unusual for employees to mention to their supervisor or to someone in my office, hey, I've got a problem. I'm going to have to take some time off and go to the doctor. And we will ask, did you do this on the job? Is it job related? Say no. No job relation whatsoever. They go to the doctor and 2 hours later they come back and said, well, the doctor said, quote, it must have happened to you on your job. It becomes a workman's compensation claim. The employer pays the bill. The doctors get their full payment for services rendered. Employers figure out ways to not hire individuals with disabilities or to release employees who develop disabilities because of the complications of workman's compensation insurance. Employees take advantage of a system. Thank heavens, as Paul Ken Mullen mentioned, it's a very small number of employees, but there's a sufficient number to cause a problem that they take advantage of the system, which will pay them money for pre-existing conditions.
I might say I'm glad you're bringing out the fact that it isn't only the employees, it's the doctors that are also taking advantage of the system.
I hope you realize how touchy this is of a subject
I hope
for
they still
to
send,
too.
I hope they still send patients to your hospital.
I want to say that when we talk about pre-existing conditions, too, that I think my hospital, as well as most other larger employers, have full benefit packages, which I think is a demonstration that they have a very strong interest in the health and welfare of their employees, whether it be life insurance, health insurance, dental insurance, long-term disability insurance. or a multiple of many other insurance programs. I think we all have the welfare of our employees at heart, because without them we can't do our job, and we can't earn a, in private business can't earn a profit, in the hospital we can't serve the medical needs of the community without employees. I've given you several examples of accidents, and there's a couple of them I'd like to go through as a type of pre-existing conditions that, that we end up with. On the first page of examples, we have case number one. It's a matter that a young man had an allergy, and every time he's exposed to certain things, he breaks out in a rash. Under case 1D, it says, at the time of the pre-employment physical, the physician noted this employee had a rash about his arms and was being treated at that time. This became a workman's compensation claim after that employee was had claimed it as a job-related item. Now, it doesn't matter whether that person worked at Rhode Island Memorial Hospital, another employer, or was at home. The person was going to have a rash whenever was he was exposed to any number of a variety of different items. And because of this allergy, once he was employed, he was able to claim it as workman's compensation, and like all likelihood, it'll be workman's compensation for some time to come. Case number two is an employee that's been employed by the hospital since 1972 as a registered nurse.
Can I interrupt a minute, Dick?
Mm-hmm.
We have about 20 minutes, so I just wondered, do you have these written here, if we could?
I do, and I have about three
on some of these
like
cases, unless you have something
I'll really shorten.
We have six more witnesses to go.
Okay. I think the samples or the cases are there where people have had conditions before coming to employment at the hospital. Their doctors have said that someday that you're going to have something done about it, and lo and behold, once they get on the job, at least it, this pre-existing condition becomes a matter of a workman's compensation claim. I think that the system is unfair to the employer, and the fact that the workman's compensation system expects the employer to pick up many problems that are not really directly related to a job, but instead there's something that's simply going to happen in a person's life. I don't think that the system is fair to the employee, because I think it encourages the employee to take steps that are really not, I don't know how to put it. I can't say they're not legal, because the system's there and it makes it legal, but I think it puts the employee in an awkward situation of putting him in a welfare situation, and with the doctors being added to it, instead of getting him back productive to work, at least he remains off on an indefinite period of time. You do have the information in front of you. I'll be more than happy to supply you with the names and case numbers if you'd like those at a later date.
Thank you, Dick. If you will take care of the doctors and Mrs. As far as their cost to the system, and Mr. Valour as an attorney would take care of the attorneys and their additional cost to the system, we'll take care of the employees as far as their additional cost to the system.
I wish it was that simple.
And there are others too. Jerry Latham, the Medford Mail Tribune.
Thank you. I am Jerry Latham, Mail Tribune, and I have two bills that I wish to refer to. One of the things, employer, unfortunately, we haven't had any major workman's compensation cases. We've had one or two are disagreeable. But the thing that I feel left out in the dark about the most is that in the forms, there's no responsibility the doctor report back what he does and gives to the state, that we have no way of knowing what this total bill is done until we find it on our billing. Sometimes the workman's compensation refers to it. I'm also been involved with the Oregon Newspaper Association, and a number of years ago we went into a group a system with the state workman's compensation. January the 1st, we went with EBI insurance and changed from the old system. Basically, the problem arose because the state, and they're developing different types of program rather than trying to service the people and employer on a base individual basis, came up with so many systems that they didn't make known to us some of the things that were available, and consequently we got involved with where the dividend, which we were receiving before, because the group association fell off. And so we feel sometimes that they're over expanding their capabilities or attempts to solve a social problem, and rather than trying to base it on an individual basis and an individual employer at about the same rate. We recognize that there is a need for a hazard classification in this area, but basically we feel that this is part of the problem with it. We want to oppose Senate Bill 376, and I understand maybe this has already been considered to the hearing you had, because we feel that the two-way system would be a step back. I understand there was good presentation on that at the hearing here a couple weeks ago, but whether this committee was involved with that, I don't know.
This committee was involved in that. And I was a proponent of, I'm guilty of being the proponent of the two-way system, but we don't have time to discuss that today. If you have a few minutes afterwards,
okay, well,
I'd be glad to discuss it with you.
Okay, well, I wish to oppose any change of the system. I think that...
Do you have a reason for that?
Yes, we just, January the 1st, came under the insurance program. We changed
EBI, out. You're with EBI now.
Yes, we're with
They're
EBI.
They're a very fine company.
I do wish to compliment the local people dealing with the state in our area. They had serviced and taken care of us, done an excellent job of checking with us in ocean protection and this. They have done a good job. But part of the job, as we say, problem is related to the state's policy in expanding programs. They spend more time on expanding programs and seem to get lost in contact with what is available to the best interests of a group organization.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Trope.
Mr. Latham, has your association of newspaper publishers taken some sort of stand against the two-way system?
I'm not on that committee.
You're not.
I work some with the AOI, but I haven't been involved. They will be giving testimony next week sometime, I think, in some of these areas.
Okay.
The other area that I wish to speak to, being in circulation from 1931 to 1954, dealing with Senate Bill 625, and we had a problem relating to newspaper carriers or independent contractors. The commission decided that they should come under an employment rating deal and arbitrarily placed in that. We met with them and got a delay in it. Out of this, we have Senate Bill 622, and we hope that you gentlemen read it, become informed, because in our particular case, we've had carrier protection insurance for all the newspaper carriers and medical coverage 24 hours a day, and we've done this since the early 30s. And so we hope that you will check out.
Is that 22 or 25, sir?
625. Yeah, right.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Latham. Our next witness is Colin Larson with the TruMix Construction.
I just want to say that I really appreciate the fact that you folks have come down and talked to us and given us a chance to speak. Since my area is in the area of aggravation and some of these areas, and they've been so well covered, I'd like to relinquish my time to other people in some of the other areas.
We appreciate that very much, because we have two, three, four more witnesses. Stuart Foster with, I'm going to ask you to help me, Phil Meyer and Deathreach.
Yes, I'm Stuart Foster with Frohmeyer and Deathreach. I'm an attorney here in Medford. We have an office of eight attorneys. We represent both insurers and employers and claimants. And probably a pretty even mix across the board. I was asked to speak in regard to the appeal process. I'm going to relate very briefly the one example of a claimant's case, which just recently was concluded. We filed the request for hearing in May of 1974. We had a hearing. Our claim was denied. We filed an appeal to the Workman's Compensation Board. The hearing officer's ruling was affirmed. We filed an appeal to the circuit court. The hearing officer's opinion was affirmed. And we filed appeal to the Board of Appeals, or Circuit Court of Appeals, and the hearing officer's opinion was reversed. The mandate from the Court of Appeals came down in March of 1977. And there was no stalling on either side in this appeal. It went through as just as rapidly as I think it possibly could have gone through, but it was tied up 3 years in the process. In my opinion, I feel that both the board appeal and the circuit court appeal should be eliminated. I have seen from
I misunderstood. The Court of Appeals and Circuit Court of Appeals?
No. The Workman's Compensation Board appeal and the Circuit Court appeal should be eliminated. This case I referred to was one that I prosecuted through the courts. My workman's compensation work is primarily defense work. But it costs my clients innumerable dollars on these appeals to go through the Workman's Compensation Board and the Circuit Court, which, in my experience, once you get into the appeal process, you're going to go all the way to the Court of Appeals anyway. And if you get a reversal at one stage, the other side's going to keep pounding away, and you're going to end up at the Court of Appeals. And so you've spent several unnecessary years, maybe, and expended a lot of money and tied up the court process. And I think the answer is to preserve, I think that our referees do an excellent job now, have a de novo appeal either to the Court of Appeals directly or to set up another court similar to the Oregon Tax Court.
Let me ask you, first then you would suggest that we go to closing and evaluation, from there to the hearing officers, from there you eliminate the Workman's Comp Board and go directly to
the Court of Appeals. Although I agree with Mr. Valeur, the outline that you suggested to him, the recommendations are certainly a step in the right direction. I would also suggest that we should seriously consider setting up a separate court of appeals for workmen's compensation cases, similar to the tax court. Have a de novo appeal to that court, and then have a final appeal process to the Supreme Court, similar to that which we have from the Court of Appeals, namely a petition for review, not an automatic appeal. The reason why I think that the special court would be more attractive is that it could hold court in the circuit just as the tax court does. We have to remember that not only are we representing employers, we're representing claimants who cannot afford, in many cases, to send attorneys up to Salem when their attorneys reside in Medford, Baker, and areas such as that. So I feel that by setting up a separate court system for workman's compensation cases, you would get more expertise. You could possibly, I'm sure you could eliminate the necessity of expanding the Court of Appeals, and you would be able to service all these claims much more efficiently.
I might say that this ad hoc committee has considered that, and that was one of the alternatives that has been considered,
And I've got one other brief comment that isn't directly applicable to the appeals process, but that is that in determinations that involve permanent disability, there is some sort of problem, and I cannot put my finger on it, but it is general knowledge among claimants' attorneys that if you have a determination that involves a permanent award, that you can appeal that determination, you can file a request for hearing on it, and 99% of the time, you can get an increase in that award, therefore obtaining attorney's fees and further compensation for the claimant. And something is the matter when with the determination process when that situation exists. And I don't know what the answer is to that.
Well, the circuit court, I think the elimination of the circuit court, I think, would help that, and that's where most of the awards are. The Court of Appeals, as you know, has been very tight-fisted as far as recently, as far as workman's comp awards are concerned.
Mm-hmm. I think the circuit court is an entirely unnecessary part of the process.
Did you disagree with Mr. Valeur, though, in terms of you put in at least one area for de novo review, as I recall, up at the Court of Appeals level or the special court. You would have additional de novo.
I would have a one de novo appeal from the hearing officers, and that would be either to the Court of Appeals or to this court's specially set up to handle workman's compensation.
That was matters. Different than what he recommended, wasn't it?
I'm not so. Yes, I believe it was. Thank you.
Thank you. The next witness, and we've got to hurry, is Gene Hopkins with the Boise Cascade Corporation.
Senator Groner and members of the committee, I just got promoted. I'm not with the Boise Cascade Corporation. I'm with the Medford Chamber of Commerce, the executive VP. However,
I'm sorry, Gene. That's what they have listed here.
Yes, I know that is. However, what I have and is being handed out to you is the material that the Boise Cascade Corporation wanted to present, and the people that would be doing this are out of town. They couldn't make this hearing. They wanted to very much. So that's the purpose for my being here, or for my being on that list. And I would simply point out that this illustrates some rather important problems that the committee or the task force, which Lynn headed up, identified this year. And we're using there the example of Boise Cascade's records, where we find that there are some rather interesting permanent disabilities, or some interesting pensions, you might say, that people have acquired as a result of both Social Security and workman's comp, which, by the way, is tax-free.
Might say that we are going to offset, our recommendation will be to offset for workman's comp to offset Social Security instead of Social Security offsetting workman's comp, and this should save a considerable amount for the employer. And this is one of the, is in our in this package that we that I've been telling you about, that this ad hoc committee has come up with.
Fine. Well, I thought you'd be interested in this information, and I thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, Suzanne Booth with the Rockefeller Deli Cafe.
Thank you. I'm not a member of the task force or anything. I heard about this meeting from Senator Hannon because about a month ago I gave him a call, and I just received an adjustment in the workman's compensation rates for our business, and I was really upset about it and called to make a complaint. I don't know what legislation is going on. We're a very small business. From everything I've heard so far, we're probably the smallest business so far represented. My husband and I own, manage, cook, and do repairs for a small cafe in downtown Ashland. And we don't have any complicated claims. Matter of fact, in the 3 years we've been doing business, we've had, I think, no more than three claims on workman's compensation, and they've amounted to minor cuts on the fingers with knives from slicing things, and one or two called for stitches. But what I'm addressing myself to here, what I would like to convey, is that the rates themselves are a burden on very small businesses. To give you an example of our case, our workman's comp is computed on a fiscal year basis. From July 75 to 76, our workman's comp premiums were $991.62, which that was okay. But what happened at the time I was contacting Senator Hannon is our rates had been usually a couple hundred dollars a quarter. I got a bill for $749 for one quarter. And I thought, I wasn't worried at first. I thought for sure it was some sort of mistake. And in checking it out and calling the workman's comp board, calling our insurance company, I found it wasn't a mistake. We had two rate increases in one term. We had been paying a rate of 4.61%, and that particular quarter there was a rate increase for restaurants to 5.5 and then across the board 12.5 increase. The net increase to us in one term was a 22.65% increase. And I still haven't paid that premium. I'm still making payments on it. But the thing that it brings to mind to me is the state has a very severe employment problem. Unemployment is up very high. And yet, as a small employer, it's very difficult to employ people with the additional costs that are related to payroll. We pay, you know, a share of Social Security, state unemployment, federal tax, and workman's comp. All in all, on top of our gross payroll, we pay about 20% in costs to various taxes. And